Welcome back to Weird on the Rocks. This is a podcast that explores the weird, unusual, strange, and unexplained, all while getting our drink on. I'm your host, Katie. So today's episode is going to be the second and final part of the Maura Murray series. In part one, I discussed Maura's life, who she was, the events leading up to her disappearance, and the investigation. In this episode, I will be diving into the different theories that surround her disappearance. If you haven't listened to part one, please go and do so before you listen to this one. My analytics always show that more people listen to the second part of my series, which I think is because people just, you know, they like to hear the theories and kind of get into like the nitty gritty details of the story. But I kind of set these up in a way that it's really important that you listen to all the parts of it so it makes sense. As with any of the cases that I cover that are still unsolved, like Zodiac or JonBenet Ramsey, there is a lot of speculation surrounding this case and a lot of conflicting information out there. I feel like the more I learn, the more I don't know, honestly. But I tried my best to put all of my research together in a cohesive and clear way for you guys so that it's easy to understand and follow. Please keep an open mind while listening to this, and I want you guys to be thinking about what theory you think fits best as you're listening to me talk. There has been no conclusion to this case, and Maura Murray is still missing. So, I mean, your guesses and theories are as good as anyone else's. If you want to find the show, I'm on Facebook and Instagram at Weird on the Rocks Podcast, Twitter at Weird_Rocks, and the website weirdontherocks.weebly.com. I don't talk about the website much, but if you're ever wanting to look at the references I use, each episode has its own page with pictures and a list of my sources. I actually just spent a lot of time on the website last week and I kind of cleaned it up a little bit. Every month or so, I put a new survey question on there that's kind of a fun question just for you guys to think about. So there's a new question on there. Definitely go check it out. As a content creator myself, I know how important it is to give credit to those whose work you use, and there's a lot of podcasters out there, some big ones I won't name, who have gotten in trouble for, you know, quoting people verbatim and not listing their sources or saying that it's a quote. So it's really important to give credit to those people who did the work before you. And so my website is where you can find all that information. Please rate and review the show on iTunes and click the subscribe button wherever you're listening right now so that you always get the newest episode. Before we get into the good stuff, I want to share this week's beverage of choice. This is so sad, but I'm on my last White Claw. We're still doing the shelter in place here in California, and I got a 12-pack of the new White Claw flavors, last week, down to the last one, so I'm savoring this one. This is the mango flavor. In the pack, it came with lemon, tangerine, watermelon, and mango, and honestly, they're all pretty damn good. I've been going through these pretty quick the last week. I'm sure most of you have had White Claw. If not, they're delicious, nice, and refreshing. It kind of just tastes like a soda, so they're kind of dangerous. All right, well, let's get into it. Cheers, and let's get weird. The prevailing theory that I find online is that Maura crashed her car, went to hide in the woods, and eventually died naturally somehow. I follow the Maura Murray subreddit, and they recently put up a poll asking for people's theories on what happened to her. The options were murder, misadventure, suicide, and runaway, and misadventure got the most votes. For the purpose of this poll, the term misadventure was defined as, quote, anything other than murder or suicide, including exposure, succumbing to injuries from the crash or a subsequent event, etc., end quote. Many believe that Maura was driving on the windy and isolated road, possibly intoxicated, and crashed her car. She spoke to Butch Atwood, the bus driver, and when he drove away, she ran into the woods and hid. Most believe that she hid because she was afraid of getting a DUI, which is actually quite common in DUI cases. Perhaps she wanted to get far away from the crash site in case the police started searching for her right away, and she simply got too far and became lost. There is no evidence that she had a flashlight or any tools to help her see in the wilderness at night. On the night of her disappearance, records show that it was actually a bit warmer than usual, around 30 degrees. However, this is still very cold and definitely cold enough to cause hypothermia in an individual. However, investigators and law enforcement did not find any evidence of her being in the woods. No belongings have ever been found, no footprints, and definitely no body. Many point out the fact that the official search for Maura did not happen until 36 hours after the crash, giving plenty of time for snow to cover her footprints. However, no new snow fell between the time of her crash and when they started searching for her, and it was not snowing the night that she disappeared. If Maura had walked on the road or into the woods, there should have been footprints still visible. Search dogs were also used to track Maura's scent from a pair of gloves found in her car. They tracked her scent about 100 feet away from where the crash happened, and then they lost the scent. However, Fred Murray, Maura's dad, said that the gloves they used were a Christmas present to Maura that she had received just 2 months prior, and he didn't think that she wore them very often, if ever. He believes that they should have used an item of clothing from her dorm room that she wore more frequently. But the entire theory of Maura crashing her car, hiding in the woods in fear of getting a DUI and eventually dying out there, still leaves the question, why was she driving on this dark and isolated highway in the first place? Where was she going and why? Most believe that Maura was trying to run away from something or someone, but what or who has never been confirmed. The first belief is that Maura did something and she was running away in order to not get in trouble. Although Maura was often seen as the girl next door and an average young adult, many believe that she actually had two very different sides to her. She was only 21 and already had several run-ins with the law. Her first offense was when she stole $5 worth of makeup from a convenience store at Army Post Fort Knox. Many point out that if she was willing to steal from somewhere with some of the strictest security in the country, what else was she willing to do? Maura had money on her and was capable of buying the makeup herself, but instead decided to take a risk and try to steal it instead. Instead of expelling her and putting it on her permanent record, Maura got lucky and West Point allowed her to transfer to UMass. Here at UMass, Maura made her next bad decision and used a stolen credit card to purchase food. She said that she found the credit card number on a receipt in a trash can, and some sources I could find confirmed that in Massachusetts in 2004, entire credit card numbers were visible on receipts, while some sources claimed that only a few digits were visible. This leads many to believe that Maura did not just find the credit card number on a receipt, but got a hold of it in a more deliberate manner, such as simply stealing someone's entire credit card. Again, Maura got lucky though, and the university police decided not to press charges since the charged amount was less than $250, but instead they put her on probation for 3 months. In the picture that campus police took of her, many say that Maura does not look like herself and has an almost evil look to her. A girl who was usually very attractive with a dimpled smile instead had big, dead-looking eyes and an emotionless expression. Some believe that this is the face of someone with no remorse who enjoyed the thrill of getting in trouble, while others point out that nobody smiles in a mugshot photo and that her expression is warranted. 3 months later, Maura was driving under the influence after attending the dorm room party of her friend Sarah, and she crashed her dad's brand new car. Again, Maura was let off easy and wasn't given any field sobriety tests. While some believe that Maura was just simply rebelling a bit and testing boundaries, others think that she enjoyed causing trouble and was on a path straight to jail or worse. Was Maura overwhelmed with the fact that she now had a rap sheet and was worried about her reputation being ruined if she got a DUI? Or did something else happen in the days leading up to her disappearance that she had to run away from. On the night of Thursday, February 5th, 4 days before her disappearance, Maura was working at her dorm security job. This job required Maura to stay at the front desk of the dorm building and check people in. While on this shift, Maura had a complete breakdown, which resulted in her supervisor escorting her back to her dorm room. Maura was completely zoned out, crying, and could only muster out the words, "My sister." Maura had been on the phone with her sister previously that night, and it was believed that they discussed something emotional. However, some believe that this is not the true chain of events. On that same night at 12:20 a.m., the morning of Friday, February 6th, 19-year-old UMass student Patrit Vassy was struck by a car when he was walking home from a bar. He suffered severe injuries and was in a coma for over a month. When he recovered, he was not able to recall much from the incident. But there is speculation that while on a break from her job, Maura was driving around and she was responsible for hitting and injuring Vassy. Now, from my research, I have found information that Maura's supervisor said her break was earlier in the night around 10:30 p.m. But I also found information that claims she had another break around midnight, giving her time to possibly be involved in the accident. Some believe that Maura was not upset about a phone conversation with her sister, but instead the fact that she had just badly injured someone and left the scene. Some also think that this theory fits because just 2 days later, her father came to visit her to go car shopping. Friends of Maura's say she never mentioned going car shopping and never even mentioned that her car was having problems. Perhaps they were buying her a new car so they could quickly dispose of her Saturn, which had damage from the hit and run. Lending to this theory was the fact that Maura's sister didn't come forward to explain what their phone conversation was about that night. In fact, it wasn't until 2017 when her sister spoke about their conversation. She explained that she had a history of alcohol abuse and had recently gotten out of a rehab facility. That night when she called Maura, her boyfriend had just taken her into a liquor store, causing her to become very triggered and upset. And she called Maura for emotional support. Her sister explains that Maura was so emotional and basically catatonic because she was just worried about her and didn't want her to relapse. But there is no actual evidence that this conversation actually took place, and many criticize Maura's sister for taking 13 years to come forward with this information. Some believe that this hit-and-run accident is what inspired Maura to leave town just 4 days later. She was already in trouble from her past behavior and was afraid that she was going to be linked to this hit-and-run and have to serve jail time and perhaps never reach her dream of becoming a nurse. However, in 2016, journalist James Renner, who runs the Maura Murray Blogspot site, spoke with Patrit Vassy about the night of his accident. He said, quote, "I never met Maura Murray. We didn't know each other. I've heard this theory, and she may have been involved, but I think it's very far-fetched," end quote. In his blog post, James Renner also brings up the fact that Maura had no reason to be in the area of the hit and run that night, and with how short her work breaks were, didn't have the time to get that far and back to work in time. As far as I can find, the police never actually looked into this theory that Maura was involved in the accident, and while some still think it's a believable story, most people have dismissed it due to lack of evidence. So if Maura wasn't running away from something, maybe she was running away from someone. And the person that most people think she was trying to get away from was her boyfriend, Billy. The first glaring detail that makes many believe this theory is Maura's behavior the days leading up to her disappearance. Maura was actively trying to avoid Billy's phone calls, either simply not answering when he called multiple times or responding to his calls with emails. There was also the printed email between her and Billy that was found on top of the packed up boxes in her dorm room, and these alluded to some relationship problems and talk about a previous infidelity on Billy's part. Some close to Maura have also said that although Billy was across the country in Oklahoma attending school, he was very controlling over Maura and kept close tabs on her whereabouts at all times. Billy also called Maura's friend, Kate Markopoulos, the day before Maura disappeared because Maura wasn't answering her phone. Although Kate has never spoke to the nature of this phone call, there is speculation that Billy was calling Kate to get information about where Maura was and why she was ignoring him. And years later, it would be learned that Billy continued calling Kate multiple times a day during the week after Maura disappeared, but she never picked up the phone to speak to him. Most who believe the idea that Maura was leaving town to get away from Billy also believe that her friend Kate and father Fred were in on the plan to help her. Maura's friend Kate Markopoulos has been very removed from the investigation and search for Maura since the very beginning, and records show that she participated in a track meet just a few days after Maura was confirmed as missing. There is also the fact that Kate attended the dorm party with Maura just 2 days before her disappearance, but she can't remember a single person at the party or whether or not Maura talked or left with anyone. Many resources I find online believe that Kate knows much more about this case than she is letting on, and that she is being secretive because she helped Maura concoct her plan to leave and get away from her unhealthy relationship with Billy. Some also speculate that Maura's father, Fred, was also in on the plan. Many point to the car buying situation as proof of this theory, and believe that Fred and Maura, in fact, never actually looked at new cars that day. Fred told the police that they had been talking about buying Maura a new car for a while, and he brought $4,000 in cash with him to visit her that weekend, in case they wanted to put a down payment on a car. Records show that instead of simply withdrawing this money from his bank, Fred actually withdrew cash from up to 10 different ATMs. However, they did not purchase a car, and this money was never recovered. There are questions around if they had been talking about buying cars for a while, then why did Fred have to withdraw the money so hastily, causing him to find multiple ATMs? It was discovered that Fred was actually doing very poorly financially at the time and was about to foreclose on his home, making it seem odd that he would be withdrawing such a large amount of money to give it to his daughter. Maura's car was still running fine, so why would a man in financial trouble withdraw such a large amount of money for his daughter if it wasn't an emergency? Many think that this money wasn't for a car at all, but instead was given to Maura to help her get away from Billy. It wasn't until 2015 that anyone spoke to the whereabouts of this money. Helena Dwyer Murray, a family spokesperson for the Maura Murray case, said on Facebook that the $4,000 was deposited back into a bank account that both Fred and Maura had access to. She said the police confirmed that the $4,000 was never touched. Although this information opened even more questions, such as when was the money deposited, before or after Maura disappeared, and how can they prove the money wasn't touched? Surely it still isn't sitting in this account. Also, if the money ever was used, there wouldn't be any proof as to who used it, Fred or Maura. The police did an initial interview with Billy and his family, where he explained that he was in Oklahoma at school during the time of Maura's disappearance. And while police ruled him out as a suspect because he was so far away, there is no record of law enforcement actually checking into Billy's alibi, but instead just took his word for it. In the 16 years since Maura's disappearance, some problematic things about Billy, or Bill as he goes by now, have come to the surface. Four women who worked with Bill at Ray Group International, an IT management company in Washington, D.C., came forward to report some inappropriate behavior that Bill had displayed. One woman said that Bill pushed her down a flight of stairs, then denied any involvement. Another woman claims that Bill destroyed ultrasound pictures of her unborn child that she had brought into the office to share with coworkers. And another woman claims that Bill talked about Maura's disappearance with her on one occasion, and he said that he and Maura were breaking up anyway when she disappeared, and that in hindsight, he's glad that things worked out the way they did. Then in 2011, the same woman who claims that Bill pushed her down a flight of stairs but had no proof had another encounter with him. And I want to add a quick trigger warning because I am going to briefly discuss a sexual assault. So please skip forward about 30 seconds if this is going to be upsetting for you to hear. Katie Pattison, who was 22 at the time, says that she returned to the office after hours to get her jacket. It was St. Patrick's Day, and a group of coworkers had left work early to attend happy hour at a local bar. Bill, who was her superior, stayed behind in the office. When she returned to get the jacket, Bill was still there, and at this point, Katie says that he seemed intoxicated. He invited her into the president's office to talk, and once she was inside, he locked the door behind her. He smiled at her in a way that scared her and proceeded to tell her that it was him who pushed her down the stairs. She tried to leave the office, but he blocked her. He pushed her face down onto a table and pushed his body against her. She struggled, and he pushed her down harder. Katie said, quote, "I just wasn't contemplating what was happening. I pushed him up, and he pushed me down again, and I kept asking him what he was doing, and he would smile or laugh and kept grabbing at my dress," end quote. Luckily, a coworker then entered the office building looking for Katie and calling out her name. Bill told Katie, quote, "Don't say a fucking word. This never fucking happened," end quote. But Katie called out to her coworker to let her know that she was inside the office. This startled Bill, who then hid under the desk. Katie let her coworker in, and they did not speak of the incident. The next day, she reported the assault to the police. Katie said that a female officer took her call, and the first thing she said was, quote, "Well, then why didn't you report this last night?" end quote. Nothing came of the allegations. Then in 2017, Katie was called by journalist James Renner and was asked about Bill Rausch. This phone call spurred her to once again call the police and once again report the assault, which was extremely difficult for her to do. She said, quote, "It took a long time for me to call myself a victim or to associate with the word victim, and going to the police again symbolized that, especially after being made to feel like I wasn't one the first time I went. I didn't want to fight anybody for that status," end quote. After the second report, Ray Group International did an internal investigation, and Bill Rausch was fired from his job. In April of 2019, Bill was indicted by the Washington, D.C. Superior Court on one count of felony third-degree sexual abuse. At this point, four more women had come forward with alleged harassment and abuse claims, and several of Katie Pattison's coworkers corroborated her story and say that she'd told them about the assault after it happened. Together, the victims were asking the court to review Bill's whereabouts in February of 2004, believing that he possibly played a part in Moore's disappearance. Throughout 2019, Bill appeared in court several times. Each time, he was alone. No friends, no family, and his wife had decided to leave him. In October of 2019, 6 months after his indictment, another victim came forward with allegations of abuse and harassment that she endured while dating Bill. The victim claims that she dated Bill for several years while he was still married and that she worked under him at Ray Group International. She claimed that Bill began the relationship via sexual messages and it escalated into a physical relationship. She claimed that soon after, he began physically and sexually abusing her. He hit her several times and choked her on multiple occasions. She claimed that often while he was being abusive to her, that he would call her Maura and would say, quote, "Maura, you're a bitch and a whore," end quote. After these altercations, he would shower her with gifts and affection. On Valentine's Day of 2018, he threw the victim across the room, causing a large gash on her head that bled profusely, resulting in a hospital visit. In March of 2019, while Bill was deployed in Africa, the victim broke off the relationship. This resulted in him stalking the victim, which could be confirmed through hundreds of texts, phone calls, and social media messages. The victim was eventually able to obtain a restraining order against him. Around the time of Bill's indictment, a close friend of his also came forward with some information for journalist James Renner. In an email, the source forwarded emails sent between him and Bill, in which Bill was bragging about creating fake usernames on Reddit and Twitter to leave comments about Maura's disappearance. In one instance, Bill made a post to Reddit suggesting the theory that Maura was bullied in college and running away from a bully, and in another post, he ridiculed anyone on the site who indulged any conspiracy theories about Maura and compared it to thinking the moon landing was fake. Under his fake username, he also frequently volunteered to be a moderator on the subreddit and said he would run it with no prejudice or bias. Luckily, he was never approved as a moderator. In December of 2019, Bill Rausch went to trial for the charges against him in regards to the victim who he had dated for several years. In opening statements, the prosecution said, quote, "The court will learn that Bill's abuse of the victim began within days after they started dating, and that the victim endured years of emotional and physical violence. Bill would choke and hit her without her consent, and would also refer to the victim during sex as Maura, the name of his ex-girlfriend who went missing in 2004. End quote. The defense argued that none of these events happened and that the victim was actually upset with Bill for never going public with their relationship on social media. The victim took the stand in which she testified to the abuse she endured for years and also showed her tooth that Bill had chipped when he had hit her. She explained in detail how Bill stalked her, called and texted multiple times a day, sent letters and flowers to her house, and used his family members' Facebook accounts to talk to her. When asked if there was anything else that scared her about Bill, she said, quote, "Yes, I mean the fact that he was indicted for sexual abuse and the fact that he has a missing girlfriend." End quote. The judge ruled that Bill was guilty of stalking and ordered him to pay the victim $1,800, which is what she paid for a new security system. He also ordered Bill to attend 22 domestic violence counseling sessions. And just last month, Bill appeared in court again, this time for the indictment against him from April of last year in which he sexually assaulted his coworker. And this case is still ongoing. The information about Bill that has come out in the 16 years since Maura disappeared has only strengthened the theory for many that he was somehow responsible for her disappearance. While some believe that Bill doesn't have a solid alibi and possibly did something to Maura himself, many believe that he possibly hired someone to hurt her, or that she was just so scared of him that she wanted to leave town. In fact, it was discovered in 2016 that the University of Massachusetts had a cabin up in the White Mountains, a cabin that you would get to by using Route 112, the road on which Maura crashed her car. Eric Yerpe, leader of the UMass Outing Club, spoke to journalist James Renner and said that the cabin was often used by the Outing Club for weekend retreats. He was able to obtain records from 2004 that showed that the cabin was booked for the weekends before and after Maura disappeared, but was vacant during the week of her disappearance. Yerpe explained that the keys to the cabin were kept in a lockbox, and anyone who knew the four-digit combination could get into the cabin. Many believe that Maura knew about this cabin and that this is where she was heading the night of the accident. But when Yerpe was asked if he knew Maura or if she ever accompanied them on any weekend retreats to the cabin, he said no. But Bill's behavior and the existence of this cabin in the mountains wouldn't be the only shocking information to come forward since Maura's disappearance. It turns out that at one point, she was having an affair with her UMass track coach. Hossein Baghdadi was questioned by the police after Maura's disappearance, where he admitted that the two of them had an ongoing romantic relationship. He said that their affair was off and on, but that they did see each other while Maura was still dating Bill. Baghdadi said that Maura had broken things off in the fall of 2003, right before she went out of town to Bill's family's house for Thanksgiving. Baghdadi, who is now a chemical engineer, was candid when talking to the police about Maura and said that it wasn't anything serious, just a fun fling. But one detail he did not mention, he often visited the UMass cabin in the mountains. When journalist James Renner talked to Eric Yerpe about this cabin and the fact that he had never met Maura, James also gave Eric a list of names of people close to Maura to see if he recognized any of them. He said that he recognized the name Hossein Baghdadi. He explained that Baghdadi often accompanied the outing club on hiking and canoeing adventures, and that he definitely had stayed at the cabin before and knew the code to get in. So, did Maura know about this cabin in the mountains from Baghdadi and was on her way there alone that night? Did she just want to get some peace and quiet for a few days and something happened to her on the way? Or was she possibly meeting Baghdadi there for a secret visit? The theories around both Bill Rausch and Hossein Baghdadi also bring up another detail in this case that has a lot of speculation surrounding that, and that is the belief that Maura was possibly pregnant. Some believe that Maura was going through something bad enough in her personal life that she wanted to run away and create a better life for her and her unborn baby. This theory began when investigators made public the fact that just the day before her disappearance, Maura had been Googling pregnancy questions. These questions included many that had to do with the effect of alcohol on a fetus. And Lieutenant John Scarinza said that he believed Maura was pregnant when she disappeared, although he could not speak on behalf of the entire police force. That was just his personal opinion. However, a classmate of Maura's came forward and said that these Google questions were most likely for one of their nursing classes. She said that they were in a class specifically dedicated to maternal health and that she had been Googling similar things the same night. There is also the fact that after her disappearance, birth control was found in Maura's car with 4 pills missing. Although this detail could fit both theories of her being pregnant or not pregnant, some believe that if she was indeed pregnant, why would she bring her birth control pills with her? And others believe that if she wasn't pregnant, why wouldn't she have brought them with her when she left her vehicle? There is also a theory that instead of leaving town to avoid trouble, to run away from her abusive boyfriend or a pregnancy, that Maura was actually experiencing some sort of mental breakdown. Young adulthood is often the time in one's life where mental health issues come to the surface due to stress and big life changes. According to many close to Maura, she struggled with bulimia. She was on the school track team and was expected to be very fit and in good shape at all times, and athletes are more likely to suffer from eating disorders. Maura's former roommate said it was well known around school that Maura was bulimic. Her former roommate also said that Maura talked about her family teasing her for being bulimic, and they would say things such as, "Why eat that if you're just gonna throw it up later?" Some believe that these unhealthy patterns, along with the fact that Maura was stealing, lying, and drinking and driving, shows that she was suffering from some serious issues. Journalist James Renner believes that her dangerous behavior, such as stealing from a military base and crashing her dad's car, were all a cry for help. She was too proud to ask for help, so instead was internalizing her mental health issues and acting out in a reckless way. The theory that Maura was mentally unwell also opens another belief by some that Maura was actually running away to commit suicide. Those who followed this belief think that she was most likely on her way somewhere in the mountains, perhaps the UMass cabin, and was going to kill herself there, but got into this accident on the way. Then perhaps she still went out and killed herself, or she died in the elements naturally first. A lot of people point to the fact that after Maura's disappearance, her dorm room was found all packed up with stacks of boxes. Why would she have packed up her belongings if she was planning on coming back in a few days? Sometimes suicidal people pack up their belongings as a way to help their family members and would rather do it themselves than have their family go through the pain of doing it. There was also the printed out email between her and Billy that was found on top of one of the boxes. While the conversation itself has never been confirmed, it supposedly showed a conversation between the two of them regarding some relationship problems and possibly an infidelity by Billy. Some think that this was Maura's way of leaving a suicide note, and she hoped this email would communicate that she was killing herself because of romantic issues. However, Maura's friends and family do not believe that she would have committed suicide. A former classmate explained that at UMass, you weren't allowed to stay in the dorm room during school breaks, and she believes that Maura simply hadn't unpacked her boxes from the break the month before yet, not that she had packed them up again. Lifelong friend Katie Jones said, quote, "When the press releases came out about her being suicidal and all the other absurd theories, it was very hard to read. I mean, yeah, people can think what they want, but those that know her know that she was a happy person. If there was something bothering Maura, she definitely would have come out and one way or another hinted that something was wrong," end quote. And Maura's other childhood friend, Liz Druniak, read the last email Maura had sent to her group of friends, saying, quote, "So this is Maura's last email to the group of girls." She writes, "Dane Cook is playing at UMass, and we went to get tickets and it was sold out. I missed out again, but I did some research and he plays in Storrs, Connecticut on February 12th, not too far from UMass," end quote. Liz says, quote, "To me, that's not somebody that was trying to take off permanently. She wouldn't just make plans and then completely ditch them in our minds," end quote. There is also the fact that the night before her disappearance, while Maura was Googling pregnancy questions, she turned in a homework assignment at 3 o'clock a.m. Many believe that if she was truly planning on killing herself the next day, she wouldn't have bothered with turning in her homework. There is also the theory that Maura indeed was not running off to kill herself, but was doing just the opposite, running away to start a new life somewhere. In the past 16 years since her disappearance, there has been numerous supposed sightings of Maura, although none of them have been confirmed. And most of them come from Canada. Over the years, people have claimed online to have seen Maura in various parts of Canada, including an anonymous Reddit user who claimed to be Maura's therapist in Canada and said that she left the US to get away from her abusive boyfriend and controlling dad. However, this post was almost immediately deleted and has never been confirmed. But what if Maura really did run away to Canada to get away from something or someone in her life? The reasons for her leaving range from running away from Billy, running away because she was pregnant and wanted a better life for her child away from her abusive boyfriend, running off to start a new life with her track coach, and leaving because she was mentally unstable. In 2018, the internet went wild with a 2015 video of a woman that closely resembled Maura. The video was of a woman in her 30s and a child at a screening of the Star Wars movie A Force Awakens. In this video, the woman and the child are scared by a person dressed as a stormtrooper and they are laughing. People were quick to point out the similarities between the woman, including her dimples, smile, and the way she laughed. At the time of the video, Maura would have been 33, matching the supposed age of this woman. And those who believed that she was pregnant when she ran away pointed out that her child would have been about 11, around the age of the child in the video. This video has never been confirmed to be Maura, but the woman in the video has still not been identified. Those who believe the theory that she ran away to start a new life believe that her father Fred and friend Kate Markopoulos were in on the plan and helped her escape. There was the $4,000 that Fred Murray admitted to taking out from the multiple ATMs. And Kate was her friend that accompanied Maura and Fred to the liquor store the night that Maura crashed Fred's brand new car after she'd been drinking. Kate has always remained very private, never speaking publicly about Maura's disappearance and never aiding in any of the searches for her. Did Maura tell her dad and friends that she was scared of something and they helped her get away? Or maybe someone else helped her? Many who follow this case closely believe in what they call the tandem driver theory. And this is the belief that someone else was traveling with Maura the night she crashed. There are three major details that point people in this direction. And that is the fact that no footprints were found, neighbors who were watching the scene did not see Maura run off, and the police dog lost Maura's scent only 100 feet from the crash site. Was someone driving in front or behind Maura, then picked her up after the crash? This could possibly have been her friend Kate, her track coach and ex-lover Hussein Baghdadi, her father, a friend, or a complete stranger. The night that Maura disappeared, there were neighbors who were watching out their windows, observing the crash and Maura herself until the police showed up. When you are watching a scene like this, you are usually looking all around the surrounding area, not looking directly in one spot. Journalist James Renner describes this as the lighthouse theory, because your eyes act like a lighthouse by scanning around. So while your eyes are fixated on one spot, you can't see what's happening to the side in the dark. Whatever happened to Maura, it happened extremely fast. There were no witnesses who saw her talk to a passing by car, walk down the road, or walk into the woods. Many believe that this means Maura quickly got into a car, as witnesses do say that several other cars drove by while the police were on their way. These witnesses say that if a stranger pulled up and talked to Maura for any amount of time, such as asking if she needs a ride, they would have seen this interaction because it would have taken some time. However, if Maura had someone she knew driving behind her who came up upon the scene, or someone in front of her that noticed she wasn't following and turned around, she would have recognized their car and gotten in quickly without a conversation needing to be had. Also, Maura first spoke with the bus driver Butch Atwood right after her accident, who asked if she wanted a ride and she declined. So why would she then accept a ride from another stranger just a few minutes later? However, the tandem driver theory still leaves the question of where is Maura now? Some think that whoever picked her up killed her and she is now dead, while others believe that it was a friend and her disappearance is not connected to the crash. Many believe that the tandem driver was a friend who Maura was going away with for a few days. Perhaps they were going to party somewhere for a bit, and that's why she took the alcohol with her. Or maybe they just wanted to get away for a few days and regroup. They could have been heading to the UMass cabin in the mountains or somewhere else. Some believe that this friend dropped Maura off somewhere, stayed for a day or two, then they had to get back to class or a job, and when they returned to pick Maura up a few days later, something bad had happened, or she simply was gone. Nobody in Maura's life has ever come forward to confess that they were the tandem driver or to know anything about another person being involved. However, some point out that if Maura was indeed in fear of someone or something, they could be hiding the truth and still trying to protect her from something even 16 years later. There is also belief that there was someone else in her car with her that night. After the crash, Faith and Tim Westman were the first to be alerted to the scene, and they quickly called 911. In this call, Faith told the dispatcher that the light inside Maura's car went on and off several times. There was a flurry of activity at the trunk of the car, and that she saw someone in the passenger side smoking a cigarette. Those close to Maura say that she did not smoke. Faith Westman told the same story and was adamant for years that she saw someone smoking a cigarette, but eventually she recanted and said that it could have been a cell phone light that she saw inside the car. So was Maura with somebody else that night? And who was it? Where were they going? Did this person harm Maura? Or did something maybe happen to both of them? Or perhaps someone was with her and is keeping a secret to protect her? The last theory I'm going to discuss is the possibility that Maura met foul play. In fact, this is what her father, Fred, believes to have happened, and he said, quote, "I think some local dirtbag grabbed her. She was in the wrong place at the wrong time," end quote. And in fact, some believe they know what this person might have been driving. A witness named Wilma Robinson came forward with information regarding a suspicious vehicle she saw the night of Maura's disappearance. In an interview found on notwithoutperil.com, a site dedicated to the case, Wilma Robinson said, quote, "I was walking that night about 7 p.m. to the local store. As I was walking up the hill, a truck passed me and slowed down. When it got to the middle of the hill, it stopped in the road. I immediately looked at the plate and noticed it was from Massachusetts. There is only one streetlight there, and I could not tell how many people were in the vehicle. As I got closer to the truck, it took off up the hill. When I rounded the corner to the store, I could see the truck in the driveway of the store. As I walked into the parking lot, which is well lit, the truck took off toward the crash site. Of course, at this time, I did not know that there was a crash. As for the red truck, it slowed, then stopped and waited for me to get closer, then took off up the hill. It did not leave the store parking lot in any sort of hurry. When I entered the store, I asked if she saw the people in that truck and she said no, no one had come in. I told her about them stopping in the hill. Then we just forgot about it. I stood in the store a while and was there when the police and ambulance went by. I never saw that truck again. The only way I can describe it is that it looked like someone who delivered wood. That was my first thought about it. Red, Massachusetts plates, and delivered wood. Either having a wood body or even just slats in the body. It was not a king cab or extra cab, just a regular truck. That is all I can tell you. I was in the store for about half an hour, 45 minutes. It was about 20 to 30 minutes after I was there that the police went by. I am not at all Maura's size, and in fact, I was bundled up that night. I believe I caught the truck off guard as I was walking well off the road, and as they passed, I walked back on, which is why I believe they stopped completely. They could not see me without any streetlights and maybe went to the store and waited for me to get there to get a better look at me. I don't know. This is just how it seemed to me. The truck didn't scare me. My thought is that he, she, they thought that I was someone else. That is what I was thinking that night. When I saw them sitting at the store, I again thought, man, they really think I'm someone else. And as I got closer and I could see the driver moving around, I was thinking, there, I'm not the person you're looking for. And he drove off. I wish to God I could remember what I was wearing that night, but I can't. Someone asked about the truck and whether it was four-wheel drive. I believe it was. I've been looking at trucks and have determined that it was definitely a four-wheel drive, or at least it was three-quarter ton pickup because it sat up high. The other thing I remember is that the window in the back was hard to see in. It wasn't very large, which tells me it was an older truck maybe, end quote. Local law enforcement confirmed that Wilma Robinson reported the truck to them, and some locals actually recall that the police were stopping red trucks in the days following Mora's disappearance. In the years since, many have tried to figure out who was driving this truck. Even if the owner didn't have anything to do with Mora's disappearance, perhaps they saw something. Some believe that three brothers, known as the Loon Mountain Three, were driving the truck that night. The brothers all worked at Loon Mountain, a small town and ski resort that is very close to where Mora crashed that night. Two of the brothers, whose last name is Glenn, lived in very close proximity to where Mora disappeared, and one of them reportedly owned a red truck similar to the one Wilma Robinson saw that night. There are also online rumors that the Glenn brothers did not show up for work the next day, although this was never substantiated. Some believe that the brothers, who were all college-aged, could have picked Mora up and then either harmed her in some way, or at the very least, know what happened to her. It is possible that although Mora declined a ride from Butch Atwood, a middle-aged school bus driver, that she would have taken a ride from young men who might have wanted to party with her. Some also believe that one of the brothers briefly was inside Mora's car with her, and that is the cigarette light that witness Faith Westman saw. But none of this has ever been confirmed, and while law enforcement did look into the three men, they were never suspects and nothing ever came of this theory. However, some still strongly believe that the truth of Mora's disappearance is somehow connected to that red truck. As mentioned in part one, there was also a man who came forward and said that his brother killed Mora and that her remains were in his A-frame house close to the crash site. This house has been visited several times by law enforcement and cadaver dogs, and each time, in law enforcement's words, the dogs have gone bonkers in several areas of the home. But no solid evidence has come from searching this house. A few samples that appeared to have dried blood on them were taken from inside a closet, but the samples were too degraded to test. And in 2019, law enforcement used ground-penetrating radar to look under the house and believed they found something. So the current owners allowed them to drill into the concrete, but nothing was found. However, some, including members of Mora's family, still think that her remains could be in or around this house. In fact, Mora's sister Julie said in an interview with Oxygen that she heard rumors that, quote, someone took Mora back to a party and drugged her or something and then buried her in a basement, end quote. So what really happened to Mora Murray? I'm going to quickly review all the theories that I presented in this episode. As I mentioned earlier, the Mora Murray subreddit that is the main discussion forum for this case recently did a poll that asked what people's theories were. The theory with the most votes at 46% was misadventure, meaning that Mora died from an unfortunate incident or mishap. The main belief here is that Mora died in the woods after her crash, with most believing she was hiding in the woods from the police because she was intoxicated and afraid of getting a DUI. This theory then leads to the question of why she was even driving out in the first place, and this branches off in a few more directions. Either she was running away from something permanently, or was going away for a few days and planning on coming back. She could have been running away from legal or criminal problems, from a possibly abusive relationship, because she was experiencing some kind of mental breakdown, or wasn't in the right state of mind, or because she was pregnant. Mora also could have been leaving in hopes of starting a new life somewhere, possibly in Canada. Some believe in the tandem driver theory, that Mora was traveling with someone else that night that was helping her and knows the truth. She could have died in the process of leaving permanently or could be alive and well somewhere. In the Reddit poll, 8% of voters believe she ran away and is still alive. There was also the theory that Mora wanted to kill herself, and either did so in the woods or went somewhere else and killed herself. And only 4% of voters believe this theory. And the last theory is that Mora was met by foul play. This was the second most popular vote with 41%. Mora could have been taken by someone, either from the crash site or after she fled the scene. She could have willingly gone with someone, or she could have been abducted against her will. This could possibly be tied to the red truck seen acting suspiciously that night. She could have been killed by this person, or could possibly still be held as a captive somewhere to this day. Maura also could have been murdered by an opportunistic killer who took advantage of a young woman who was alone and killed her at or close to the crash scene. So, what do you guys think? What theory sounds the most plausible to you? During my research of this case, it reminded me a lot of the JonBenet story because just as one theory would make sense, there would be a detail about it that just can't be explained. For unsolved cases like this, I usually go back to Occam's razor, which is a principle that states that the most simple solution is usually the correct one. I personally believe that Maura was going through a really rough time. I can't say for certain whether or not she had mental health issues, but it's clear from some of her actions and behavior that she was definitely dealing with something. I think the fact that she already had a history of drinking and driving, liked to steal, and suffered from an eating disorder all point to her feeling unstable and out of control. This is a girl that, for whatever reason, continued to make bad decisions without ever really being held fully responsible for them. I don't believe that she was just unlucky. She had a pattern of reckless behavior and was, in a way, crying out for help through her behavior. Maura was extremely intelligent and was very well liked, and I think that she was battling some inner demons and was self-medicating with alcohol. I believe her relationship with Billy Rausch was very unhealthy and that they had problems, and that this, combined with her personal struggles, was just too much for her to handle. I think she wanted to get away for a few days, whether that she was alone or with somebody else, and that something happened in the process of her leaving town. I don't know where she was headed, and nobody ever came forward to confirm that she had reservations anywhere, but Maura was very impulsive, and chances are that she was just going to drive until she found somewhere with vacancy. I don't think she was the type that necessarily had to have reservations somewhere. There's also the chance that she was going to the cabin in the woods that the UMass Outing Club owned. But I do believe that she had the intention of coming back to school the next week. I believe that she was definitely drinking and driving and was kind of in a, you know, like vacation mode, so to speak, where you're kind of just like, screw it, and you behave really carefree and just have fun and relax because you're on vacation. I think she crashed her car, whether it be due to drinking or not, and that she fled the scene to hide in the woods after she talked to Butch Atwood. She already knew that she was on thin ice because of her past actions, and she didn't want to get caught in yet another drinking and driving accident. She thought that she could hide in the woods for a bit, then come out when the police were gone. I think she ran deep into the woods, because she was a track star after all, and simply got too far. One thing that I haven't seen discussed in my research was the fact that both of Maura's airbags were deployed, most likely hitting her in the head. Combined with the fact that she was drinking while driving, she quite possibly could have suffered from a concussion, or at the very least, was disoriented. Butch Atwood, the bus driver, did have a very brief encounter with her, and he said that she seemed really shaken up. Perhaps she was rattled or experiencing a concussion and made a poor judgment call, such as going too far into the woods. The concussion, combined with being intoxicated, could have made her not feel the cold as much, especially if she was running, and didn't realize how serious it would be for her to go into the woods. Now, this brings up the fact that the dogs lost her scent 100 feet from the crash site, and that her remains have never been found. And I'm just going to chalk this up to basically dogs and humans aren't perfect. Perhaps the dog made a mistake. Fred Murray himself criticized the police for using brand new gloves of Maura's to track her scent. So perhaps the scent just wasn't strong enough for the dog to follow. As for her body, it's possible that she fell down into a ditch or climbed up a tree or built a shelter for herself that has just never been discovered, perhaps under some sticks or in a ravine or something. There's also the possibility that an animal dragged her into their den or into a covered area where she was never found. Or perhaps she unknowingly crossed onto private property and died there from the cold. And then when the owner of the land found her, they disposed of her body because they were scared of getting charged with her murder and just buried her. I think that whatever happened, Maura didn't get very far that night from where the crash happened. I found an article online that talks about how geographic information system mapping, or GIS, is used to help locate missing hikers, and their data showed that 50% of hikers are found within 1.9 miles of where they originally went missing, and 75% of them are found within 1.6 miles. So I don't think that that night in the cold and in the snow that she got very far. While cases like this are interesting to research and speculate about, most of the details I have found are pure speculation and hearsay. People on Reddit and blog sites can say whatever they want without any proof to back up their claims, and people will, you know, stumble across it and read it as if it's a true fact. Like with a lot of the stories I've covered, social media and the internet in general help bring awareness to these cases, but they can also taint the investigation with lots of inaccuracies and false claims just being thrown around. Sadly, unless something major happens in this case, I don't think we're ever going to know what really happened to Maura. But for Maura's sake, I hope that whatever occurred to her that night after she crashed her car, that it wasn't anything too brutal and that she didn't suffer. But as always, I want to know what you guys think. Do you agree with my theory that she hid in the woods and, you know, died from exposure? Do you think she could possibly still be alive and well somewhere, living under a new identity? Do you think her boyfriend, Billy Rausch, who has now been charged with sexual assault, had any influence or part in her disappearance? Do you think that she was abducted or murdered? I would love to hear what you guys think, or if you have, you know, connected any dots that I didn't see. I also encourage you guys to do your own research. There's so much information out there about this case. There are some really great blogs, lots of videos, podcasts, whole TV shows, and books that are all solely dedicated to the search for Maura. So check those out if you guys want to hear more about this and, you know, get down into the rabbit hole and do some searching for yourselves. And I want to end this episode with a quote about Maura that came from Bill Rausch's mother, Sharon Rausch. She said, quote, "I wouldn't describe her as complex, but she was so multifaceted, you know? She could be serious, she could be so funny and witty, she always had the soft little giggle, and she was very soft-spoken, but she was really fun-loving. She loved life, she loved to laugh," end quote. All right, until next time, cheers and stay weird.
That was a Titancast episode.